Hello, everybody. So let's start. Are there any questions about the course? So the first lab, the first practical assignment, first homework assignment is in preparation, and you'll probably get it announced on the webpage and circulated to you in the later portion of the week. You get to do this practical in teams of two, and there are 110 students in the class, which conveniently turns into 55 teams of two. So you might start thinking about who might be your partner for the first practical assignment. And once you have a practical partner, you can email me your names. As we get closer to the day when the practicals really need to be done, if you don't have a partner, I will choose a partner for you. So any questions? Okay, well, we were, was that a question? So we were just getting started with trying to isolate these dark parts against the light background. We want to recognize them, and at the moment we've just got a grid of a quarter of a million pixels, and we somehow want to extract useful information from that. And as we had been discussing in the lecture question at the end of the last lecture, one of the techniques that we could use, for example, is a kind of thresholding technique. It's based on this observation that if this is our image, and this is a histogram of the pixel values in that image, sort of from, with the intensity values from 0 to 255, and this is how many pixels that you have of each of those different intensities, you notice that there's two really obvious peaks right in here. Okay, one corresponding to the part, one corresponding to the background. And if we chose some sort of a value somewhere in the middle here, say around about 100, we could say, well, the part is everything that's below 100 and the background is everything that's above 100. So this is a thresholding technique. Okay, and often it works pretty well. This is just about as perfect as you can get for doing this kind of technique at two very distinct peaks. They're well separated. There's this little extra hump down here that turns out to be related to the shadow. And if we really wanted to put our threshold, we should probably put it in right here. Okay, but it may be a little bit hard to find that little kind of tiny little notch right there. Sometimes it isn't even a notch. There's also a bit of a spread, as well as because of the shadows are sort of blurring a little bit of out of defocus. There's a little bit of this sort of variation in the background. Kind of that gives what gives you the spread. There's illumination variations. That also helps with the spread of these two peaks. And if we're just looking for peaks, there's another little complication. You'll notice there's another tiny little peak in here, and there's a kind of tiny little peak or two in there. So just looking for peaks is not always the easiest of things. Okay. Fortunately, this is, in this case, it's a really trivial to separate the two. So once we have that threshold, and here's a little bit of MATLAB code that actually does the thresholding. We go over every pixel from all the row for the height of the image to the width of the image. And if that pixel value is less than a threshold, okay, then we ignore this line for a minute. Then we say the output is equal to 1, and otherwise it's 0. So we're going to turn all the object pixels into 1 and all the background pixels into 0. And there should be a couple more sort of end statements over here, but a lot of times I just leave the end statement off just for clarity on the slides, but you need them when you write your code yourself. Okay, the one thing that I sort of said, let's skip over for just a minute, is this line right here. So I don't know if we talked about it before, but MATLAB has a comment character. That's this percent sign. And everything that follows on from the rest of the line after the percent sign gets ignored by the MATLAB parser. Okay, so I've just commented out that line right here. What I was trying to say is that not only could we have an upper threshold, okay, for the part, but we could also conceivably have a lower threshold. Maybe we've got a scene where there's a couple of different objects of different intensities, and maybe we just want to pick out a narrow range, in which case we would use something like a high threshold and a low threshold to pick out the range that we want. Okay, so here's our distribution. here's the threshold I picked, here is the result that we get from using that little bit of code right there. So now it's pretty obvious. Where's the object? Where's the background? We still not quite made it there because this is still an image, and so we still have a quarter of a million pixels in this image. It's just that now they're labeled with 1 and 0, so it helps us easier with our analysis. Okay, well, I just sort of picked that 100 as a kind of threshold sort of out of the air. Okay, but now we're going to look a little bit at how we might automatically pick that threshold. And here we're going to exploit the fact, in this particular case, that we've got these two great big peaks right here. We want to somehow use that. As I mentioned before, there's a bit of blurring. There's actually values in between here related to sort of blurring around the edges of the objects. There's all these little extra peaks. So we're going to tidy up this histogram by introducing a new technique called convolution. Okay, and we'll come back to actually applying to the histogram in a minute, but first I'm going to do something with convolution in a general purpose, general sense. Okay, so there's those of you who picked up the notes last time, there will be a little section on sort of background sort of illumination and things like that. I've decided to move that to the next lecture, so just skip over that for the moment. The next bit of notes, we might get to it today. Okay, so convolution is a general purpose function. If you take a course in image processing or signal processing, this is one of the very first things that you will learn about is convolution. And really, it's basically saying the output value is a weighted sum of the input values. Okay, and here you can choose weights to do different kinds of things. For example, you can use it for noise removal or smoothing, or you can use it for feature detection or differentiation according to the kinds of weights you choose. You can use it for matched filtering. If you have a particular shape that you want to look for in the image, you can do a convolution that maximizes the kind of the likely positions where you might find that shape. Okay, you can do that in individual signals as well too. It's called matched filtering is one of the things you can do with this by having a mask that's appropriate to the shape that you're looking for. Okay, we'll see some examples of that just in a minute. It's also a kind of general linear operator, so that means that if you multiply one of the components by some scalar, that's this A right here, and then do a convolution, that's equivalent to doing the convolution and then multiplying by the scalar. So. Okay, so that's just a little bit of introduction. Here's a more sort of formal kind of description of it. Here we're going to do the convolution in one dimension first. Okay, so here's our signal. It's a little sort of step function. It has a high value, and then after a certain number of positions, it drops down to a lower value. So this is sort of value versus position. And we're going to do a convolution with it. We're going to do a convolution with two different kinds of masks just to show you that you can get two different kinds of effects. But the general form for this convolution is all, in both cases, is the same. So here's our input. That's this function right here. And here's our weights. And so what we do is for every value, every position of the output, when we want to calculate the value of the output at position x, we take a weighted sum of the input values around x. Here we're going sort of n values to the left and n values to the right of the current value. And we add them all up with a given weighting factor. And the choice of the weights creates different kinds of effects. So here's two different sets of weights. This is a Gaussian mask. These are the values, the weights here for this particular case. This is a kind of smoothing sort of operation. So we take our original input. When we apply this convolution with this Gaussian mask, we get a kind of smoothed edge. It still is a step edge, but it kind of goes down more smoothly. Hi there.
Sorry, so when you're referring to masks, is that ultimately the weighting function that you're applying?
Yeah.
Convoluting?
Yeah, I've been a little bit sort of sloppy in referring to both mask and weight kind of interchangeably, but I think a lot of people just do that. And yes, that's what I meant. Okay, so here's one particular mask that does a kind of smoothing. This mask right here is a little bit different. So this is a kind of a zero value, and it has some negative values and positive values. And this is a kind of differentiation type mask. So when you do the convolution with this mask on this original function, it produces this as an output right here. So there's a little peak where there's a large change in the values, and it's essentially zero where there's no change in the values. And then there's also this is a little boundary effect related to the length of the arrays and that sort of stuff you can kind of ignore for the moment. Anyway, so with the change of two different masks, we can extract two different kinds of information. What are the two levels, and where does it make large changes, depending on whether we want to do smoothing or differentiation. And then there's lots of other things that you could do as well, too, as I said before. So that's it. That's in one dimension. One could also do this in two dimensions. So it's a similar idea. We have an output array. In this case, it's going to be indexed by the two dimensions of the array. And it's going to be a weighted sum of the input values. Only in this case, we're going to have our weighting mask be a two-dimensional mask. Okay, so it goes, this is a 2n plus 1 by 2n plus 1 values, sort of here. Here's an example of one. Okay, and it sums up all of the input values weighted by the values in this mask. So this is an example of a smoothing type mask. You can sort of tell it's smoothing because it's got sort of big values, big positive values everywhere. And if you apply the smoothing mask, actually there's one more little detail here. Normally you want all the weights in the mask to add up to 1 if it's a smoothing type mask. So that's why I've got this 1 over 273. If you added up all the values here, they add up to 273. So this just scales them. What that means is then when you apply this mask, you don't get the image getting brighter or darker. So that's for smoothing type masks. For the derivative type masks, you want all the values to add up to 0. So that if you apply this mask to a constant signal, then you get 0 as the output. Anyway, that's just sort of a little detail. Anyway, so this is our mask. It's a smoothing mask. You can tell there's sort of a big hump in the middle, all positive values. And if you applied this convolution mask to this original image, right here, you get this image right here. You could see that it's definitely been blurred. Some of the small features maybe are disappearing because they've been blurred away. For example, that little wire right here has just about disappeared in the blurring kind of thing. By the way, this is one of the mobile robots that was built in Edinburgh about 15 years ago. All right, so those are examples of a one-dimensional and a two-dimensional convolution for smoothing purposes. We can do a two-dimensional convolution also for edge detection. So here is the Freddy robot and Robin Popplestone, one of the main inventors of that robot. So as I said before, this is the robot that you'll see over in the museum in Chamber Street. And we're going to do two kinds of edge detection. One is we're going to detect horizontal edges, okay, such as this one back here, or we're going to detect vertical edges, such as these lines along here. And we can do that by using two different masks for the convolution. So this is the mask for the horizontal edge detection. It has a very kind of typical structure. It has all positive values on one side, all negative values on the other side. And it really is saying, okay, is there a large difference in values between, say, the upper bit and the lower bit of this sort of black region right here? Okay, and because there is, we get a very strong response to the signal, as you can see in this line right here. Similarly, we've got a mask with a lot of positive values on one vertical column and a lot of negative values on the other, and that says, is there a large change vertically across a vertical edge? So there's a sort of very bright here and it's darker right here. Consequently, we get a strong response over here. Okay, so that's a kind of example of the use of masks for edge detection, these convolution masks. And it's the core of a lot of different computer vision, let's say edge detection algorithms, use some sort of masks a bit like this. Convolution also seems to be happening in your brain. If you look at this sort of grid right here, it's called the Hermann grid illusion. If you look at sort of these little regions right in here, you'll probably see it looks a little bit dark. It looks like there's a sort of a fuzzy dark spot, you know, in the corners right here, okay, where in the middle of the white lines, okay. And in fact, there are no, the pixel values are all pure white up and down the lines, okay. But somehow we see a dark sort of fuzzy sort of dark spot there, and that's an illusion caused they believe by a combination of the architecture of your eye and your brain. And in the back of your eye, in your retina, there are, there's these retinal, the ganglion nerves that go into your brain, but the calculation that those nerves are doing is based upon combining the signals from about a few hundred different rods, in the case of black and white vision, from a few hundred rods in the back of your retina. And the kind of computation that they're doing is based on this idea of this sort of center surround. So if you made sort of the assumption that, say, there's 125 different rods all in here, and they're all wired up together, this is the weighting that they use for the wiring them together. So the rods that are in the center, they do a kind of positive weighting on the number of photons that come in, their firing rate. And for the rods around the periphery, they do a kind of negative or inhibitory kind of sum to all the firing rate. And when you put all the two of them together, it's the equivalent of this sort of convolution in two dimensions that we were looking at just a minute ago with a mask that looks something like this. And when you apply that to images like this, in the middle right here, you get a perfectly good signal, but where you get these little connections right here, it's got a kind of combination of plus and minus from all the dark stuff around it. And the net effect is that you get a little bit of a kind of a dark signal that sort of comes out of this convolution signal. So they believe that's a kind of the explanation for why we see these sorts of dark spots in here. And if you wanted, you could take this grid with a mask like that and do a convolution just like we explained a minute ago, and you would find a kind of result a little bit like that. Okay, so back to our thresholding selection. We remember we had our threshold here before, and we've got our two peaks, but they're a little bit ragged. And now we want to apply our convolution to the ragged histogram and get a kind of smoother histogram out. Okay, so here is the filter we're going to use. We're going to use a smoothing filter. We're going to do this in one dimension. We're not smoothing the original image, and we're smoothing the histogram, so we're doing this in one dimension. So here's a kind of smoothing filter, and when we apply this filter to our original histogram, we get this nice and smooth histogram now. So there's none of these little ragged peaks that you saw before. Okay, it's just two nice big peaks here. Okay, so how do we do that in MATLAB? Well, let's go back a slide, and that's what we do right here. The core of that is this line right here. It's the MATLAB built-in convolution function. It's a one-dimensional convolution. And we pass in two arguments. One is the thing that we're smoothing, convolving. Okay, so that's the histogram, okay, that we had from previously. And the second bit is the smoothing mask, or the filter, we're going to pass in here. So this is the first and second arguments corresponds to, so here's the first argument right here. This is the output, that's this temp 2. And the hist is that ragged sort of histogram that we had before. Okay, so that's the core of it. Where do we get the convolution mask or our filter? Well, that's called the filter right here. MATLAB has a built-in function called Gauss-Win. Okay, it produces a Gaussian window, a little sort of a normal distribution kind of shape. And it has two arguments, one of which is effectively the width of that. That's the standard deviation in your normal distribution that you're all used to. And the second is the length of the array that you're going to put this distribution into. Okay, because for example, like the normal distribution never goes to zero. It goes, you know, at minus infinity and plus infinity, it's sort of asymptotically equal to zero, but it isn't exactly. So you have to kind of choose a width, you know, for how much that you're going to take in your array. And here, I don't know, I think I said 50 values, and you can sort of see the 50 values sort of right along here from 0 to 50. Okay, so that's this bit right here. Remember I said that we wanted to make sure that all the values in our smoothing arrays added up to 1. So that's what this next step right here does, is it just normalizes to make sure that it has that all sums to 1. So I use the MATLAB built-in sum function to add up all the values in this. And then I do a kind of pointwise division of this constant into this array. So it divides it into all of the elements of the array automatically. And that gives me my normalized filter right here. Okay, and then we do our convolution, and then there's a little bit of a tidying up that we need to do right here. And the problem is that the way MATLAB, when it does the convolution, it has a sort of a 10-length filter and a 100-length chunk of data. It's going to give you an output that's got that 100 plus 10 at one side and 10 at the other side, because it doesn't know what you want to do with the mask when it's off the edge of the data slightly. So actually, we're going to have something like 120 long output, of which we only want the 100 in the middle for our result, because the rest is sort of blurring off the edges. And so that's what we're going to do right here. This is temp2 is our output array. It's 120 long, and we want the inner 100, for example. I actually say 255 in our case, or 256. Okay, but you know what I mean. We want the inner bit. Okay, so we're going to create the output, which is a subset of the inner bit. And here we're going to use another kind of MATLAB sort of constructor that maybe we haven't seen before. That's this colon right in here. So this is the way that MATLAB specifies a range of values. If you remember back to our for loops, in our for loops, we saw that colon before. So this one colon height actually specifies a list of values, okay, from 1 to height. It's just, it's kind of implicit here. And if you're used to, you know, other languages like C or Java or something, it kind of means something slightly different. Okay, it sort of says it goes from the range 1 to height. Okay, well here actually that constructor is actually creating a list of values. And it works the same in this particular case, but we can use that fact that it does something slightly different here. And so in this case, what it says, we're going to create me a list of values with the first value being offset and the last value being length plus offset minus 1. And so it creates me a list of values, and then when I use that list of values to index into this array, it gives me the values corresponding to all that list of indexes. So it's a kind of MATLAB sort of you know, compact syntax for picking out a subset of this array right here. Well, we'll see this a few other times as we go along. Okay, anyone want to ask any questions about that? Yeah?
Question, what is
length
defined?
Length, it kind of came, I think, from a bit of the code from outside or whatever. So that'll be the length of this histogram right here. So I didn't put it on this slide, but it came from before. Okay. Oh, actually, there's one more little bit right here. This floor command is this MATLAB sort of implementation of the normal sort of mathematical floor command. It takes a value and rounds it down to the integer value, the next smaller integer value. Okay, so what we've seen right here is we started off with a variety of image capture problems and some ideas about how you might fix up those problems or avoid the problems. You'll probably want to use some of those in the laboratory for your practical assignment. Okay, and now we started to look at how to differentiate our simple parts from the background. And as part of doing that, we introduced this general technique of convolution and then used that for our histogram smoothing and then our threshold selection. Okay, so that's all from that bit of the lecture, and now this is a good opportunity for those of you who don't have the notes for the next section that sort of says, Lecture 5. There's a whole pile of them down here. Great. Okay. We're going to just start this bit with a little bit more MATLAB exercise in finding finding the actual threshold value. So we've got our smoothed histogram right here, and we're just going to look at a little bit of MATLAB code to kind of find the little maximum valley right here. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to have a little scanning over the array of this histogram. We're going to find the biggest peak, okay, which we're going to assume is the background. We know something about our scene. We're going to exploit some of our scene knowledge right here. We're going to find the biggest peak first, okay, and then we know because it's light background and dark object, then we know that the dark object is going to be on this side of the peak, so we're going to then scan and find the next highest peak to the left. And then we're going to find the lowest value between these two peaks as our threshold value. So that's what we want to do. We're going to have a little MATLAB to exercise it. Okay, we're going to start off with another little bit of MATLAB that is really convenient and a little bit complicated. Okay, so there's this MATLAB find command. And find works over an array, okay, which is going to be this temp one. That's our smoothed histogram. It says find, what I'm trying to say is find the value in this array which is equal to some other value. And it turns out what it's equal to is what I'm interested here is the peak value, the maximum value in that array. So find the position in this array that has the maximum value. Okay, so this find statement doesn't give you the value. What it does is it gives you the position of the value. So it gives you the index into the array. Okay, so peak is now going to be the index position of that peak value. So that's the, so here's the peak. Okay, we can find that value using the max command and find the position right here, sort of about 160 or something like that. That's where you use the find command. So that value peak should come out at 160. In fact, actually, this find command will give you a list of values. And fortunately, in our case, we know that there's only one maximum peak. But if, for example, there were two values that had exactly the same maximum right here, it would give you a list of two values. So you do have to be a little bit careful about that. But here, fortunately, because of our convolution, we've only got one peak. And I can kind of simplify it. So here's our peak value, and now we want to find the next highest peak to the left of that. We're going to exploit our property knowledge, and so we're going to do that by searching. Here's a for loop that goes from image position number 2 to the one less than the current peak position, and the condition that we're going to use right here is that the position we're interested in is this position I. And for it to be a peak, it's got to be bigger than one position to the left, and also bigger than one position to the right. Or actually, here I say it's got to be greater than or equal, just to catch the cases where there may be a little bit of a flat spot on the peak. Okay, so those are two of the conditions. Okay, so it's got to be bigger than the value to the left, bigger than the value to right. That defines it to be a peak. And we're also looking for the maximum peak. So therefore, it's got to be bigger than the previous maximum that we found right here, which initially is minus 1. So any peak will start off. Okay, and if that's the if this condition is met, then we store the peak value right here, and we also store the peak position. So basically, it's just a loop scanning along looking for a value. There's another little bit of MATLAB that you haven't seen before, and that's these three dots right here. If you have a, this is actually a bit of MATLAB here. It's not just notational sort of thing on the slide. Okay, if you have a MATLAB command that's too long for one line, and, well, actually you can go like, you can have MATLAB commands that are maybe, you know, 200 or 500 characters long, but for reading purposes, it's not always very easy. So you may want to pack a command onto several lines. And what this little bit right here says to MATLAB is that what's on the next line is a continuation of what's on the current line. Okay, so in fact, this bit normally would appear out here, but we've wrapped it around a little bit for, let's say, the beauty of code. Okay. Right, so we found the peak to the left. That gives us the that position right here, and now we need to find the valley in between. So we're going to go from values that are just to the right of the lower peak to values that are just to the left of the upper peak, and we want to have a value which is, in this case, it's a minimum, so it's got to be smaller than the one to the left and smaller than the one to the right. Again, we've got the equal just in case there's two flat values at the bottom, and it's got to be the smallest peak, so we look for to make sure that it's smaller than the previous one we found. And if it is smaller, then we record it, the value and both the value and the position. That's our threshold that we're going to use later, is the value, the position of the smallest peak. Okay, so that should be pretty straightforward MATLAB, and also it sort of implements all the ideas that we've been talking about pretty straightforwardly. Any questions here? Okay, so that's one technique that one can use for finding a part against the background. And we're now going to look at a couple of other techniques that maybe can be applicable in different situations. So that one that we just looked at works great if you've got nice, clear, dark parts on light background or light parts on a dark background where the values are all nice distinct, and you've got, when you look at the histogram, it's got these two great big peaks, and everything works just fine. Okay, well, real life is not always like that. That first one is a kind of thing that you want to engineer in an assembly line or factory or something like that, so it's easy and works right every time. But the real world, when you don't have as much control, sometimes things aren't as good as that. Okay, so for example, here's another image. Okay, again, sort of dark part on light background, but notice that actually because the illumination gradient is really kind of pretty bright up here, it's pretty dark down here, and in fact this dark corner down here is darker than this bit of the part right here. Okay, and if you did a histogram of this particular image, this is the histogram that you're going to get. You might just say, so where do I put the threshold? Notice it's really ragged, and there's lots of different values right here. In there, and I suppose just put the threshold somewhere in here, probably you'd get most of this part, you'd probably lose a bit of the corner of the object, and you get a bit of stuff down here, not exactly what we want at all. Okay, so what we're going to do instead is a technique called adaptive thresholding. And what it does is it doesn't use a global threshold for all of the image. What it does is it sort of says for every pixel, okay, like this pixel right here, okay, I'm going to look at a region of values near that pixel. And I'm going to choose my threshold based on the values in that neighborhood. And the way it does it is it's you have your window, so this window maybe is 100 by 100 window. Okay, so it's going to, you know, if you're going to have a pixel right here, it's going to take 100 by 100 window around it, sort of about this size. And the threshold calculation is based on taking the mean value of the pixels in that window, Okay, so the average all right here, they're sort of all pretty bright. And then you subtract some sort of constant from that, okay, for example, 12. And that gives you the threshold to use at that particular pixel. Okay, and then you do that for every pixel in the image. So every pixel you calculate its own local threshold based on the values in the window, and then you do the kind of thresholding sort of trick that we looked at previously to decide whether it's a 0 or a 1. Right.
Why do we subtract a constant?
Why do we subtract a constant? I don't really have the answer to that. That's just the way the algorithm was defined. I think if we I thought about it a little bit. So if you're in a constant region, then the better to say nothing than to give you a lie, right? Okay, so here's our code for that. Actually, if we do that algorithm first, this is what we're going to get. Okay, so although that image was really pretty ragged, we did a reasonable job of extracting the shape. Okay, and so you can see the boundary of the shape. Now you notice that there's something that's a little bit weird, and that's the, there's a bit of white region in the middle of the object. That's because the mask is only 100 by 100, and this object right here is more than 100 pixels across. So inside the region right here, you look at the average value, and this effect is related to that constant. When you take the average value and subtract a constant, you're going to get a value which is lower than the dark value right here. And so therefore, all the pixels there are going to be brighter, higher than that value. Okay, but and so that's why there are all these zeros right in here, or all the white spots right in here. We don't need to worry too much about it because we can sort of say, well, they're in the interior of the object. We can just sort of ignore them. Okay, what's a little bit more of a problem is some of these other dark spots here and there, okay, which are have also been selected by the thresholding technique and maybe related to noise and a little bit of rubbish in the image or something like that. But there are techniques for cleaning these guys up as well. Okay, so if we go back and look at the MATLAB code. Okay, so here is our window size. Here's our input image. Okay, and we use the MATLAB size command to figure out the number of rows and the number of columns in the image, the height and width of the image. And we're going to create an output image that's exactly that size. It's not necessary, actually, to pre-create your out images. You could just sort of store the values in one by one as you generate the values. But it's a lot slower because MATLAB is sort of doing dynamic memory allocation all the time when you do that. So if you pre-allocate the image right here, it's just faster. Okay, so that's why I did that. Okay, so so this is half of the width of that mask. So I take the thing divided by 2, do my floor command, so that's half the width. When I do my processing, I move away from the edge of the image, so I don't start on row 1 to row H. I sort of move in a little bit because I got to get my 100 by 100 mask in there. And I just, rather than worrying about what happens at the edge of the image, I just moved in a little bit from the image. So this moves in some of the rows and some of the columns. Okay, so here's our input image, and I'm going to get my 100 by 100 window around the current position. This is another little sort of MATLAB kind of common notation right here. So remember we were talking about this colon as defining a range of values. It's a list of values, effectively. So here's my current position I, and I've gone back half the distance of my mask, and here I've gone plus half the distance of the mask on the other side. So this gives me a range of row values, and this is going to give me a range of column values. Net result is it's going to pull out about 100 by 100 sub-image out of the current image centered around position ij. So whenever you want a little sub-block of the image, this is the kind of construction that you want to use. It's all sort of built in. Okay, yes, of course you could do a couple more inner loops and sort of copy it over, but that's sort of slow and you have to write lots of more lines of code for that, so you might as well use this sort of construction right here. Okay, so that gives me my 100 by 100 sub-image. And now I need to find the average value in that sub-image to select my threshold. So here I do that. Okay, it looks a little bit funny because I got this mean function in here twice. MATLAB does things sort of by rows and columns on arrays. So the first one finds the average of each of the rows, and then the second one and gives you a one-dimensional array as the output, and then the second one does the average over all of those row averages. Or maybe it's the column average. I can't remember exactly. You need to look up the manual page to decide which way it averages them each time. But anyway, the first one takes a two-dimensional image, gives you a one-dimensional array, and the second one gives the average over that one-dimensional array. So that's the average over the whole image, and then I subtract my constant right there. That gives me my threshold. Now I look at that individual pixel, and if it's below the threshold, then I set it to 1, and otherwise I set it to 0. Okay, so that gives me my results. Okay, so that's one possible technique. That one's a little bit of a slow technique. But it's a technique that you can use when you have no control really over the image itself. And the reason why it's slow is because at every pixel you've got to grab all the 100 by 100 window around it and average all those values. Sorry? Yeah.
We move the window on each pixel.
Yeah.
So the pixel should be like centered if you're not at the
image. I didn't do it. Or maybe I did do it. I didn't mean to do it. Sorry, I think you better ask that question again.
Okay, so if we're not at the edge of the image,
yeah,
and we like can move left or right, the pixel must be at the center of the window?
Yeah. Well, okay, so if you have an image that where this what you're interested in goes all the way up to the edge of the image, you have to kind of adapt this technique because that 100 by 100 window is going to be off the edge of the image. And you can imagine, you know, you could say, oh, well, I'll do an 80 by 100 window or a 70 by 100 window when you get close to the edge of the image if you want. But there's different ways to adapt it. Here, just for the sake of something simple in the lecture, I just said, well, we'll make sure we've got the window in the middle of the image, so I moved away from the edges. Right. Okay, so those were the two techniques that you can use if you don't really know anything about the scene to begin with. Now we're going to look at a couple of techniques that you can use if you know something about the scene. For example, you might have a fixed camera, and so you always know what the background is. You just, the parts may move in. For example, if you're wanting to do surveillance or something like that with a fixed camera out in the city, you know where the streets are, you know where the shops are. What you want to do is detect the people. Well, all the background is going to remain pretty much constant. Okay, so you want to just detect the person. So we're going to exploit some of the knowledge about the background. Okay, so this is a technique that we can use if we've got some sort of a known kind of background. And we're going to exploit a little bit of physics right here. It's sort of embodied in this little bit right here. Okay, so the amount of light that you get off of an object is a function of two things. One is how much light lands on the object and how much of that light gets reflected. Okay, so here is the reflectance of the background. This is how much light gets reflected, and this is the illumination. Okay, so this is the light that comes off the background. Here's the light that comes off the object. Okay, and again, it's a function of how much light lands on it and how much gets reflected. Okay, well, we may not know whether a pixel is object or background, but we can sort of make the assumption that we could take maybe a background image previously where there was nothing in the scene and get an idea of what the background is. So one of the techniques for finding whether an object pixel is either object or background is a kind of ratio technique that takes advantage of the fact that it's constant illumination, because it's a fixed scene, multiplying either object or background. Okay, so if we look at the ratio, sort of this of an unknown pixel divided by the intensity of the background, we took this image in advance. Okay, if the object is the background, then the ratio of those two is going to be equal to 1, approximately. A little bit of noise in here because we're taking a new image. On the other hand, if we've got a dark object now suddenly appearing on our background, that ratio will be considerably less than 1. Okay, and consequently, all the values should be pretty much in the range, sort of 0 to 1 for the kind of situation we're looking at. So we can pick a threshold right here of, like, say, 0.6. So let me just see if there's any other. Okay, so if we go back to our sort of over-illuminated part that we did with our adaptive thresholding, here it is. Here's the background, okay, when the part has been removed. Okay, and if we do that sort of ratio trick at every pixel and then do the thresholding, okay, we're going to get a histogram that looks something like this. Here was that original histogram from just the left image. Okay, there's the histogram of this one. But after we do this ratio of effectively dividing every pixel here by the pixel value in the background, we get, and then compute the histogram, we get a histogram that looks something like this. Okay, and we're back to the situation that we can work with again, because we've got, you know, two sort of big peaks. They're a little bit ragged. We do our convolution trick to sort of smooth it. We can pick a value somewhere here in the middle, okay, and use that as our threshold, and the results come out nice. Okay. Now, I make a little comment here. There's a little bit of a shadow back on this image, sort of along the edges right here, along the right side and the bottom side, because of the bright light up here. And the threshold that we've chosen has included that shadow, sort of as part of the output image. You can do it. Okay, good. Okay, so that's so this ratio kind of technique works. Yeah.
During the images that we take successively have some amount of noise, especially in the illumination. Is there a technique to remove that noise?
Okay, so you're saying that when you take, for example, two images consecutively, they'll have roughly the same pixel values, but they may vary a little bit because of statistical fluctuations. Yeah. Okay, well, so if you have a bunch of images, let's say you have a constant camera, a constant scene, if you could, for example, have the luxury of taking more than one frame of the same data, then you can reduce the noise in the image by some sort of smoothing filtering. So you, for example, you could average the images together. And just like if you had a whole bunch of single noisy values and you averaged them all together, the mean of that would be a better estimate of the actual value than any individual sample. And the same you can do with images. You average the images together. Each pixel, you average all the pixels from the past to the future, and that gives you a better estimate, averages out the noise. Okay, one could also use a median filter rather than a mean filter. Okay, and that sort of picks out the middle value of all of those. If you have, for example, random fluctuations or something like that, median might be better. Also, for the first lab assignment, you'll want to use a median filter because you're not going to have a background image. You're just going to have 100 frames of the video, and the parts are going to move past. But because the parts move past, if you looked at any individual pixel, 90% of those will always be background. Okay, but sometimes some of the values will be the parts itself. If you averaged them, you would get a kind of average sort of view, okay, which includes some of the background pixels. If you took the median, since 90% of the pixels are all of the background, the median will pick out a background pixel. Okay, so that's why you want to use the median filter sometimes as well. Okay, so just a quick question right here. We've got 2 minutes, so you get 1 minute to talk to your neighbor, and then we're going to have a quick answer right here. So think and talk fast. Okay, your 1 minute is up. Anybody has any suggestions? Yeah, that's certainly an important problem. Is if it's highly textured, sometimes you'll have pixel values in the background are the same as the foreground pixel, and you can't tell which one is which. Okay, you'd have to use a bit of context. Any other thoughts? Okay, well, in fact, except for that particular condition, this technique of dividing by the background will still work. I mean, it doesn't depend really on any particular value in the background. What you want is the background value in one image to be the same as the background value in the other image. Okay, if we divide by the background values, then if it's a background pixel, it should have the value 1. And if it's not a background pixel, it should be either sort of considerably lower than 1 or considerably higher than 1, depending on whether the new pixel is either brighter or darker than the background. So even though you do have this large illumination gradient and a textured field, this should actually still work pretty well, except for in the one case that was pointed out here. All right, okay, so I'll see you on Friday.
You can't actually
measure them. I mean, what you can measure is you can measure this value, and what you know is it's the product of those two, but you don't know which one is which.
Oh, okay.
Now, there are techniques that you can use to estimate that reflectance, but we're not going to talk about it.
So these are the values, basically, of the image itself, one taken from the background and one taken from the object.
Yeah. So we don't...
We don't know this relation.
Well, we know it's a product, but we don't know what are the values of the individual components. But so we don't know that, but when we do this ratio, if you divide, you know, object by background, these illumination terms that cancel out.
Right. So we will get the ratios of the reflectances of each.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
That way we'll use the mean purple and the median purple.
Yeah.
But yeah, one of the things. In the homework assignment, it'll explain that. Yeah.